following is a previously broadcast program. No drag. Papa's got a brand new bag. It's a jack. He's on the fly. Don't play him cheap, cause you know he ain't shy. You're doing the monkey, the mad potato. Jump back, jack. See you later, alligator.
We're back. It is Tuesday evening, and you are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and I'm in studios with
Renee Jordan.
And we have Anthony Highland, and he is joining us all the way from Hawaii. He's a man who strives for greatness by telling his story through poetry. He has a passion for motivational speaking and educating young minds, and a lot more. I'm very, very happy that you're taking time out of your schedule, because I know you're a busy man. You're working multiple jobs. You're an entrepreneur. You're a father of three wonderful children. You know, so you got a lot on your plate. So thank you very much for being here tonight with us.
Absolutely.
Because it's COVID times, when we start off the show, we'd like to just do a check-in with our guests. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. I know COVID has really derailed a lot of people's plans. I know I was supposed to go skydiving for my birthday back in March, and the island ended up getting shut down. And I was like, oh, man, you know. But, you know, the good thing about experience is that they can still happen, you know, once all of this subsides and we go back to, I guess, what we consider our new normal, right. If you will. So in that regard, you know, some of the experiences that I would have liked to have, we kind of had to push them a little bit more so to the right, but in hopes that things would let up. But my family is good. We've not contracted it, me nor my three children or my wife. Definitely prayers out to the families of those who have lost loved ones. I actually lost two of my childhood friends. It's rough on a lot of people, you know. Mm-hmm.
So I know that you're also a military man.
I am.
And I'm curious, because we don't often get military men to come on the air and speak with us. And I'm curious if it is that you could share how the military has, like, adapted to COVID. Like, what are some of the measures that they've used in order to ensure, you guys' safety during whatever it is that you have to do, whatever drills and stuff like that. If that's something
While I can't speak for the entire U.S. military, because of course, you know, I'm not a spokesperson, right. But I know specifically for me and, you know, my specific shop in command, we have, you know, regulated hours to whereby, you know, it decreases the amount of people that are present in the office, as well as when we go out, you know, for different missions and things of that nature. But then more so, I think the communication has been what's best, because one thing that I can say as a whole, because I come from a military family, that the military does is focus on family and ensure that they're not putting the service member in a position to whereby they have to choose between the military or their family.
Oh, wow.
So I do think that, you know, more specifically for my command, that they've done a great job communicating not just with me, but with my family as well.
Right. So I follow you. I followed you on TikTok. That's how I discovered you. And I find you have an amazing voice. And we share something in that I'm also a spoken word artist. I'm a poet. That's my roots. And I'm just curious, like, I know a little bit of your story because I've followed you on your lives, and you talk very openly about what you've been through, your life experiences. And I'm curious as what was your journey in getting to poetry and now moving on to, like, wanting to be a motivational speaker and wanting to become this internationally worldwide renowned speaker?
Really and truly, and I champion this slogan, poetry saved my life. I grew up in the inner city of Philadelphia. I grew up in the foster care system. The first 5 years of my life, I spent in foster care. And then from there, just kind of bouncing around from home to home. And one thing that stayed consistent was this anger that I had deep down inside of me, mainly because of, you know, I wanted to know who my father was. Right. And my entire goal, and it's interesting, is that I wanted to become so famous that he would find me before I find him.
Right.
And in that, you know, this anger that I had, you know, I've always excelled in school. I skipped a few grades in the earlier years, straight A's all the way until, you know, high school. I got 1 B from Miss Johnson my senior year. She gave me an 89, and I still feel some type of way about it.
My dad would say that the teacher does that in order to motivate you to work even harder the next time.
Man, that was some nonsense, man. That was some nonsense. She messed up my perfect record. But anywho, I had this teacher, and I thank him for allowing me to say his name. His name is Joshua Trott. And, you know, he was a white male in an inner city school, just seeking to curb the educational disparities and the tumultuous mindsets that a lot of us have toward not just education, but toward the world in general. And he would see me get suspended for fighting and things of that nature. And, you know, again, my education never slipped. My grandmother was all about education. So I made sure I got my work, went into the school, got my homework, all that stuff. But he said, "Have you ever thought about writing poetry?" I'm like, "Poetry? Poetry for the suckers. I'm not writing no poetry. You know, one fish, two fish."
Roses are red, like, violets are blue.
So he was like, "Nah, I got an aggressive form of poetry." I said, "Aggressive? He said, "What's that?" He said, "What about slam poetry?" I said, "First of all, anything with slam sounds good to me."
Right.
So he put me on to this organization that I essentially grew up in terms of the poetry scene, called PYPM, Philadelphia Youth Poetry Movement. And right. They're still going strong. They've been to the Brave New Voices multiple times. And in that, I found my voice. I found a way to get out all of the anger and the discontent and, you know, all of those feelings that I was feeling deep down inside. But I was able to allow myself to, you know, put it down in a way that, you know, I could utilize my expansive vocabulary. You know, I dealt with this idea of identity crisis, to whereby my vocabulary was seen as essentially a virus,
yeah.
As if I was trying to be something that I wasn't. Or more specifically, my classmates would say that I'm trying to talk white, essentially. Utilizing a specific vernacular to whereby growing older and I come across AAVE, it's just like, oh man, why didn't I know this when I was younger, you know?
And pause, just so that our listeners know, AAVE is?
African-American Vernacular English, just so that people truly understand and to educate themselves on, you know, why we essentially speak the way that we do, and that intelligence in and of itself is not synonymous with any specific group of people. Yeah. You know, anybody can pick up a dictionary and, you know, learn a few new words, you know, but are you using them in the proper context? And in that, what I came to find is that a lot of people were intimidated by my intelligence, and I allowed it to get me down. There's a poem that I like specifically. It's entitled Our Deepest Fear. And the part of it that I love so much is that it states that you're playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking yourself so that others feel comfortable around you.
Yeah.
And for almost my entire life, that's what I was doing. I was shrinking myself so that others feel more comfortable around me because they didn't have the level of vocabulary that I did. But then I also had to learn is that you cannot just be mistreating people, or what I call now intellectually bullying people, because of your knowledge and or your expansive vocabulary. So whereby you see it as a means of diminishing someone just because you know a few bigger words than them, and you're able to, you know, perpetuate this this false bravado complex of, oh, I'm better than you because I'm smarter than you. When the reality is that we can break it all the way down to its core and still come to an understanding. And the biggest misconception is that we have to agree to understand each other, and we don't. We don't have to agree to understand each other, but I believe the biggest divide between understanding and misunderstanding is just listening. It's just listening.
Yeah.
So turning to poetry is what allowed me to find my voice and then go off to college and then begin my public speaking journey, to whereby I was originally a sociology major. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the coursework and I was just like, yeah, you know, I don't think that's necessarily for me. And then my one of my advisors, Ms. Jamie Bradford, who is still my mentor to this day, now I've been removed from college for, I don't know, 6 years. Yeah. you know, she was like, how about mass communications? And I'm like, mass communications, what's that? You know, TV, you know, broadcast journalism, radio. I'm like, you can get paid for talking? She said, yeah, you can get paid for talking. It's called motivational speaking. And I was like, oh, the people that, like, come to the school and stuff. I was like, wait, they get paid to do that? Oh, bad. Oh, that's about to be my major. So I switched my major to mass communications. Thank goodness I hadn't got into my coursework just yet. And I began my journey. I paid my roommate for a logo. Originally, I was Highland Enterprises. And I think that's very vitally important that we invest in those that are around us as well, even on our journey to success, that sometimes people think that, you know, you're looking for a handout or you want the what we call the homie hookup, when the reality is that he was building his platform just as well as I was building mine. So when I would do my promotional material, not only am I promoting myself and my talents and abilities, I'm promoting him and his graphic design work as well.
Exactly.
And then we formed a group called the Intellectual Brothers, to whereby we would travel to local colleges and universities doing our poetry, doing my other two brothers at the time, they were rapping as well. So they would rap and do spoken word, and I would just do spoken word. And then my junior year, I got involved. I joined my fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, the oldest, the coldest, the black and old goldest, to whereby I started the Belford V. Lawson Oratorical Competition. And I think in terms of people ask me, you know, I do interviews or, you know, people, you know, come on my live streams on TikTok. Well, what got you like legitimately into like public speaking? It was winning that first competition. You know, I went into it and, you know, I'm very transparent, as you see on my live streams. And I'm going to be honest, I didn't really take it as serious as I felt like I should have, but I won first place. And that let me know that other people were taking me more serious than I was taking myself. And I didn't like that. So I made it my goal. So you have the local, which is your chapter.
Right.
You have the district, then regional, then national. So the local, my chapter was just like, hey, listen, public speaking is what you do. Hey, we're going to push you to the district. You know what I mean? Go ahead, go do your thing.
Right.
So I said, okay, cool. I went to the district. I won first place. And I'm like, wow. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to make it my goal. When I go to regionals, I'm not going to read off the paper. I'm going to memorize my entire speech. You're going to memorize your speech? Yes. I'm going to memorize my entire speech. On that stage, I believe there were six or maybe seven of us. Nonetheless, I was the only one that memorized my speech.
Wow.
And I believe that is what allowed me to stand out on that level and win first place on the regional level.
Yeah.
To whereby I went to the national competition and then I placed first runner up, which was essentially, for all intents and purposes, second place.
Right.
But if it's one of those competitions where if anybody was going to beat you, it was going to be that guy that beat you.
Right. It was like splitting hairs, right? Like it was, the judges were sweating as they were like trying to figure out.
It's still years later, there's still a discussion on whether or not we should do like a follow up just to see like how well we've progressed through the years. And I'm like, I have nothing to prove. You know, he has
what do you think it was that gave him the edge?
I think the timing mm-hmm. of it. So I went more toward the beginning and he went more toward the end. Mm. So when you think about a speech competition, oftentimes the one that's most stuck in your brain is the one you heard most recently. And there were people who would make the argument that maybe if I would have went last with my speech, maybe I would have won, you know, yeah. But I don't really like playing the what if game, you know, I'm a very transparent competitor. I truly do believe that I won.
That's all that matters,
but
right?
But if anybody was going to beat me, it was going to be that him. Brother, you know, yeah. And we actually formed a group, which was powerful in and of itself. We formed a group within GroupMe. To whereby we still communicate to this day, all of the brothers that were assembled on that stage, and we're all in different areas of our life, whether it be healthcare, hospitality management, me being in the military, this gentleman, I believe he's in government. I believe he's in corporate America. He's in corporate America. And we're just all in different walks of life, but yet we're still able to come together and essentially associate ourselves with what we consider the common man. To whereby our social status and or, you know, our occupations don't allow us or force us to perpetuate this mindset or ideology, push this ideology that we're better than people because of where we work at or because of the status that the world would put us in with not only our jobs, but our family structures as well. Mm.
You know, as you were talking about the whole competition and going first and last, it reminded me because I've been on the slam scene a lot here in Montreal. And usually the person that goes first is the one that kind of sets the minds of the judges. So indeed. If the first person was really, really good, then the bar is set at a certain level. And then you're either going far down or far above that. And so if the last person is like on point, the first person kind of, as we say in Jamaica and Terrace, you get joke because, you know, it's like.
Absolutely.
You were first, and that your level could only reach an 8.5, and that person is a 10. So, even though if you went last, you probably would have had a 10. But yeah, no. So I totally understand the whole score creep happens as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think also too, there's a lesson that I've learned in slam poetry that I make transferable to life, and it's similar to what you just talked about. I think slam in and of itself is so finicky because, like you said, you'll never know what could be a 10 given the atmosphere, given the demographic of the judges, mm-hmm. given the political or social climate of the world, to whereby one poem that might have done better in a different venue at a different time, you know, does better at this point in time. One thing that I see too is that you will have a preset group of poems that you are prepared to do to whereby you see the energy in the room going a certain way. So if you hear love poem, love poem, love poem, love poem, and now you're switching to talk about childhood trauma, you're either going to do one of two things. Either one, you're going to completely tank the energy in the room.
Yep.
Or two, you're going to astronomically transform the energy in the room. And literally, it comes down to the person. It comes down to the person. And I think that's, I take that mentality with my TikTok sometimes when things happen in the world and massive amounts of people are pushing a certain notion about a specific event. In my mind, I think if I'm going to take this a different way, am I going to go all the way in a different direction or am I going to go halfway in a different direction and then revert back? Because then the question becomes, if you're going to revert back, why even try to attempt to change the energy if you're already going to reinforce the energy? So I think in terms of taking a stance on things in life, that we need to ensure that we're taking a firm stance so that people know that where we stand and that if, in fact, we are going to acknowledge that of those that have consistently perpetuated and or pushed what I call a groupthink mentality, then you go with that. You either go with that or you change the energy altogether because then you end up confusing people when you play the fence. But you can be objective, but playing the fence is a dangerous game. It's a dangerous game.
Yes, yes, yes. Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, we are talking to Anthony Highland all the way from Hawaii in the States. We do have to take a little break, but we're going to come back and talk more because this is a really interesting discussion going on. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. ¶¶
My baby don't care for cars and races. My baby don't care for high tone places. Liz Taylor is not a star, and even Lana Turner's smile, something he can't see. My baby don't care, who knows? My baby just cares for me.
We're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson. I'm in studios with
Renee Jordan.
And we have on the air with us Anthony Highland, multi-talented entrepreneur, family man, and TikTok master, as far as I'm concerned. Anthony.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity as well to just coming, you know, have this discussion with you all. And I think it's, you know, a testament of itself to the power of social media and just, you know, connecting people in a way that, you know, transcends the thought process. So I'm just appreciative and let's get into it.
Yeah. So before the break, you started speaking a little bit about TikTok and what you consciously decided to use your platform for, and you have a ridiculous amount of followers that just keeps on growing and growing and growing, and I love like just watching it happen live. So tell us a little bit about your platform, because you don't only use it for multiple things. So tell us a bit about that.
So my username is iSpeak1906, and I did that strategically because I do believe, so I've been studying social media for the past 8 years, and I believe that social media in and of itself is essentially an extension of our lives. Now, regardless of how transparent you decide to be on it, what ends up happening is either you do one or two things. Either you completely change people's lives or you destroy people's lives, you know, or you just fall on this this weird gray area to whereby you're just existing in the atmosphere, consuming everyone else's content. And which is cool, too, you know, which is cool, too. But I chose that specific name, iSpeak 1906, because I speak is what I do. I speak. I'm a professional speaker, artist, and it's what, you know, my passion. And the 1906 comes in with my fraternity. So I figured that as a dual opportunity to be a conversation starter. So most oftentimes when people ask, you know, those that speak or are, you know, spoken word artists or, you know, public speakers, they'll latch on to that aspect. And then I have my fraternities and sororities, or what we call the Divine Nine or Panhellenic Council, within the Greek world. They'll see the 1906 like, I wonder if he's an alpha. And then it is essentially a conversation starter. So when I first started TikTok, my wife, she actually, about 18 months before I joined the platform, she was on it, watching people's content, looking at the little dances and things of that nature. And she brought me across one of my brothers, who I now call brother, the Conscious Lee.
Right.
And he essentially puts out intellectual content, debunks certain myths within the political spectrum, in the world in general, and things of that nature. So in my mind, I'm thinking, wow, if this brother can gain this amount of followers, and I think at the time he might have had 240, maybe 250,000, to where by now he has over 700,000 followers.
Wow.
I figured I could do that too, you know, but do it in a way that's organic to me. Mm-hmm. And that I know that there is an audience of individuals whom cater to intellectual content. So I said, I'm going to start off with what I know best, which is my poetry, my public speaking. So I just started posting my poems. I've had professional recordings of some of my poems. I record most of my speeches when I go to events. I said, I'm just going to, you know, post snippets of, you know, what I, you know, what I know to be true with myself and my platform. My first month, I gained 40,000 followers.
Wow.
My second month, the first week into my second month, I gained over 100,000. Still new to the platform. I'm just like, whoa.
So when did you join? When did you actually join TikTok?
March
24th. 2020.
2020.
like most TikTokers this past year.
Yeah. So, you know, in that, I was just like, I was like, you know, let me join the platform. Let me just see what I can do. Let me see how effective I can be. And it literally, it blew up. It blew up fast. Like I said, I gained a platform and, you know, people knew me as the poet guy. And what I saw was a lot of people were associating me with the Conscious Lee. And I was just like, wow, that's, you know, that to me, that's powerful. You know, the fact that, you know, people are making me synonymous with this individual whom I have much respect for.
Yeah.
And in that, what I came to find is that people would, they would latch on to my page and to my poems, and they would say, I think March 30th is when I blew up. So I joined on the 28th. March 30th is when I blew up. My video did, and I'm looking
at how many videos did you post up until that point?
Three.
Okay.
This was literally my third video. Right now, that video is sitting at, and when it blew up, it had something like 120, maybe 130,000 views. Now it has 332,000 views, 111,000 comments, and 585. That was my very first viral video.
Wow.
My second viral video is what actually ended up getting me an interview on internationally renowned LGBTQIA plus radio station. Was the second one that I posted, and I posted this one on.
And these are all poems?
Yes.
Okay.
So the first
what
poem
was the content of the first and the second poem?
So the first poem was entitled, and thank you for that question. That's a very, very important question. So I published an album entitled Metaphorically Speaking. It's available on all streaming platforms. And the second poem is not on there, but the first one is. The first one is entitled Black Girl Magic. And it was a poem that I wrote for my daughter, essentially letting her know that, you know, regardless of what the world may say to you, you are beautiful. You know, your melanin is beautiful. Your hair is beautiful. Don't allow anyone to tell you anything different, not even me, you know. And that one just went crazy. The second one I posted, I put the caption on it, the father that every LGBTQ child wishes they had.
Yeah.
And essentially what I spoke to in that video was that if my son were to come home and tell me that he was gay and or bring a boy home to say that, hey, you know, dad, this is my boyfriend, there would be no change. There would be no, oh, wow, what in the world? Because I would give the same energy that I would give to him bringing a girl home to him bringing a guy home, because who he decides to love, it in the grand scheme of things, it's none of my business. Is this person respecting you? Are they loving you? Are they cherishing you? If they're not of your same background, are they learning about your culture? You know, are they going above and beyond? That video did 600,000 views. I'm not sure how many likes or anything like that. But right now it's sitting at 726,000, 726,000 views, 266,000 likes. So in that, those two videos gave me my platform. They were like the beginning. Those are what people make me synonymous with. So when
and why did you choose? Why did you choose that as a subject matter for your second poem?
So for me, I think the journey that I've been on. So my younger brother is gay, and seeing some of the things that he dealt with growing up in our own family structure, as well as you know in the school system, from essentially straight black men and the stigma of homophobia within the black community. I saw that as there's not enough straight black men speaking up about being allies to the LGBTQIA plus community. Yeah. And I'm an unapologetic ally. And I believe that people have the right to love whom they decide to love. And what I came to find is that I had to confront my own biases toward the community. Not that I've ever diminished or disrespected anyone, but most of my opposition
was unconscious biases. Like,
absolutely, but mine was based in.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Right, mine was based in religion from the way in which I was brought up. Oh, you know, my grandma, you know, she would say, "Oh, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve." And you know, with us as children, you know, we go with whatever you know our parents say.
Yeah, you absorb that.
Right.
So how did you sort of deconstruct those ideas to come to this new understanding?
I had a powerful best friend. My best friend, her name is Benita. Oh, man. I'm talking ally to the community. She's going to pride marches. You know, she's going and, you know, volunteering and all those types of things. And when we got together, ironically, you know, my wife and her actually have become best friends. And she's my oldest daughter's, my oldest child, rather, was my daughter, her godmother. Mm-hmm. When we dated shortly for a stint while I was in college, she is one of the main reasons that allowed me to confront or assisted me in confronting those biases and deconstructing those mindsets that just because you have a religious belief doesn't mean that you should exclude an entire community of people from loving who they love. Right. And again, you know, I was never like homophobic or transphobic or anything. I never talked down to anyone. If I seen someone and someone was disrespecting them, just like any other person, hey, yo, leave them alone. You know what I mean? I'm not for that. But my mindset was homosexuality is a sin. You know what I mean? From what I knew growing up. And it was just like, and even educating myself on the Bible. And again, that's a whole nother conversation for a whole nother day. But just, you know, a lot of the mindsets that we, you know, peddle, we don't realize where they've come from. Yeah. And when you have someone so down for, you know, the cause, essentially, you have to understand that it's not just your interests that are at stake. It's not just your life that is at stake. And, you know, the community in and of itself has been fighting for years, just for basic rights. And then you align yourself, you know, for me, I've been an activist for 13 years, you know, so getting out in the streets, marching and protesting and signing petitions and things of that nature. And then you look at the struggle of the LGBTQIA plus community, not correlating it, but you look at it, I don't play the oppression Olympics. You know, the community has been through enough in and of itself to whereby I don't have to get into that, what I call the semantic argument of oppression. No oppression is enough oppression. You know what I mean?
But just to sort of tip the iceberg a little bit, maybe not to go too deep into it, but how does someone like yourself who has like a religious background and religious ideologies and ideals sort of accept that other worldview without without being like being for it but not being against it, if you get what I'm saying?
I left religion.
Okay.
So I now consider myself a very spiritual being, on a journey for gaining knowledge, giving reverence to my ancestors. Because again, I had to ask myself, why am I following this? I grew up Baptist Christian. So I had to ask myself as I got older, why am I Christian? Am I Christian because, you know, I love going to church? Am I Christian because that's all I knew? And when I got to the core base of things, it was because it's all I knew. Yeah. And then I started doing research. I came across ancient Kemet. And I started doing my research and I realized that organized religion is just not for me, you know, to whereby I can now liberate my mind. It's not to say that you can't liberate your mind. If you follow a religion, it's just I call it my spiritual journey. So I learned that I can be on my own spiritual journey without having to feel the need to justify it and or defend it against someone that may say, well, why aren't you Christian, or why aren't you Catholic, or why aren't you Buddhist, or why aren't you Islamic, or whatever the case may be. It's just not for me. It's not my spiritual journey, and I don't demean or diminish people as a result of that. And I think that mindset in and of itself toward homosexuality being a sin is perpetuated a lot in the Black church. You know, and it's an uncomfortable truth that, you know, I don't mind speaking and taking whatever backlash comes along with it, because one thing that I've learned is that when you make a statement, you got to stand on it.
Yeah.
And when you have unequivocal truth on your side, the only thing that you're refuting is ignorance. So when people tell me, oh, it's not perpetuated, show me where it's not. Show me where it's not, where you have scores of Black men that grow up feeling the need to hypermasculate themselves to prove their masculinity, to whereby they'll bring violence toward an individual that shows the smallest of interest toward them. You know, if a gay man gives you a compliment, that is one of the highest honors that you can receive? What? Boy, because gay men gonna tell you the truth. Just like children, just like old folk. You know what I mean? Gay men gonna tell you the truth. So, again, I had to realize, too, that I don't have to hypermasculate myself. Mm-hmm. If a gay man approaches me, listen, brother, I'm not interested. All right, wait, brother, I'm not interested. Now, if it escalates past there, it's because I'm consistently saying, hey, listen, I'm not interested. It's not a need for me to hypermasculate myself to prove my masculinity, because I know I'm not gay. You know what I mean? Yeah. I have a beautiful wife. I have beautiful children, you know, and, I love her. So, you know, in that regard, I don't feel the need, and a lot of men feel that need. And again, confronting that mindset, and here's the bigger piece to that, too, confronting those around you as well. And that was another thing that I had to do, because you are the company that you keep.
Yeah.
As much as people don't like to accept that notion, you are the company that you keep. So I had to confront those that were around me. Hey, listen, I'm not going to be around you if you're going to be peddling these types of mindsets, because, again, who they decide to love is none of your business.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Who they decide to be with is none of your business. That's nothing to do with you. You know, has nothing to do with your finances, has nothing to do with your day-to-day living, you know? So and in that regard, that I had to
you?
Learn.
How does that person loving the person that they choose affect your life? What does it change in your life? It doesn't change anything.
It doesn't, in the grand scheme of things. And oftentimes what will happen is they'll do like I did growing up, and they'll push this rhetoric that, oh, I'm trying to save the next generation. Save them from what exactly?
Yeah. There's so 7.5 billion
of us. Confronting their own, right. If you get them to start confronting their own mindset, just ask them questions. Oh, I want to save them, you know, from influencing the future generation of doing what? Loving who they want to love? So now you're becoming the very thing that you're saying that you demise, that you despise.
You're becoming an
oppressor. And then you'll see the wheels turning in their head. So you're saying you're trying to protect them while also contributing to their oppression. And then you see the wheels turning again, and then they'll just walk away. or they'll be like, you know what? Wow. I never thought about it like that. And those are the moments that I live for. Now, of course, it'd be willfully ignorant of me to say that there aren't certain groups of people. And I think I'm speaking specifically from the Black male perspective. It's willfully ignorant of me to not mention that there are people who perpetuate this mindset that I don't care, you know, what your religious background is or your beliefs. I just don't like it. Okay, that's cool. But you don't have to bring violence toward. You don't have to disrespect. You don't have to demean. Have whatever views you want to have.
Yeah.
And I think that's the place that we've come to now, to whereby if you don't like something, everybody's just not supposed to do it.
Yeah.
And life doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Wow. We are engaged in some really, really interesting discussion. Just in case you're tuning in for the first time this evening, which you shouldn't be, because you should tune in every Tuesday evening from 7 p.m. But we're talking to Anthony Highland. He's a spoken
Absolutely.
Word artist, a motivational speaker, and just... he's an entrepreneur, just got a lot of stuff on his plate, family man. We do have to take a little break and come back. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Yes, yes, Wes, we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson. I'm on the air with...
Renee Jordan.
And joining us all the way from Hawaii is Anthony Highland, a man who strives for greatness by telling his story through poetry, working motivational speaking, with engaging with young minds, and way, way more. Just his resume is extremely, extremely long. Yeah. And he's a king in his own rights. so we've spoken quite extensively about, you know, yourself as an individual, being a military man, using your social media platform to speak out on many issues. One of the issues that I see that you're very vocal about on your platform is, you know, you're a survivor of abuse. And you encourage other people to speak out on that. Would you be willing to tell us a little bit about your story in terms of that?
Yes.
Especially as a black man, because as black men, we don't speak about things that we go through on that level at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the experience in and of itself and through the great works of therapy and, you know, just, again, confronting my own mindsets toward therapy, I am a firm advocate for mental health resources. You know, we do very little on addressing the causes, but we put so much emphasis on what the outcomes are. So growing up, seeing my mother get abused and even trying to defend her and, you know, ending up homeless, you know, as a result of it, you know, was a different experience. I came home one day from school and her abuser had actually discharged a weapon towards her to whereby, you know, the casing was, you know, still in the wall. And, you know, it wasn't even a second thought to defend her. And in doing so, you know, I was told to pack my bags and leave, you know. So, I was very confused. I was very hurt. And I was just like, you know, I don't understand. And for a long time, you know, as a child, we grow up with this mindset, more specifically as a black male, that, you know, when a girl hits you, that, you know, she likes you, yeah. You know, or, you know, she has a lot of interest in you.
And vice right. versa, girls and, are also, you know, taught if a boy hits you, he likes you.
Right, which is probably one of the most tumultuous ideologies to peddle to children, to whereby, you know, growing up, I kind of looked at it that way until I got to college. And I actually was in an abusive relationship to whereby, you know, the young lady, I mean, I myself, you know, I'm 6 foot, 230, you know, I'm pretty decently built, you know, I ran track, I played football, you know, I played basketball. And, you know, this young lady, she was, you know, 5'7", maybe 130 pounds soaking wet. So people would look at that like, oh, well, you know, you're so big and, you know, she's so small. And it's just like, the verbal and physical abuse that I endured, you know, people are just like, well, you know, why did you just fight back? Or, you know, why don't you? And to me, it's just, it comes off so gaslighting. Yeah. Because although it's easy to say that, in that moment, you don't realize how powerless a person feels.
Yeah.
Or how they've convinced themselves that this is what they deserve. Or, you know, this is just, they do it because they love you. You know, and, you know, my grandmother, she taught me and my brothers this as, you know, as children. And it didn't really click again until I got to college. Love does not hurt. Mm. Love is a blissful feeling.
Yeah.
Love is a passionate feeling. Pain hurts. Pain is what hurts.
Yeah.
So in that, I had to, you know, number one, stand up for myself and say, hey, listen, you know, statistics say it takes 7 times to leave before you actually leave, you know, a domestic violence situation, whether that be verbal, mental, physical, sexual, emotional, religious, anything of that nature, 7 times.
Yeah.
To whereby you get that, you get to that point of, you know what? No, you're not going to do this to me because I'm much more than this. And I just, you know, I stood up for myself and she broke up with me.
Yeah.
And in that, I realized that I can't just allow someone to take advantage of me on that regard. And that lesson clicked.
Yeah.
Love does not hurt. Pain hurts. So even in talking about it, one of the things that I found is that most men are not very sympathetic or empathetic toward a man speaking up about said issue. Let's go a little bit deeper. When I was 13, as well as when I was 17, mm-hmm. I was sexually assaulted by a family member. And, you know, I wasn't believed. Again, 6 foot. At the time, I was maybe 210-ish. You know, I got that good old marriage weight. Yeah. I wasn't believed, you know. And the mindsets that some of the men around me had were, you know, things like, you know, well, you should have enjoyed it, or, you know, why would you snitch, or, you know, not realizing the emotional trauma that I dealt with for years trying to heal from that. And again, I keep saying grandma, you know, God rest her soul. My grandmother is pretty much who raised me. You know, she taught us that you want to know, well, she asked us, or she made this statement rather, you want to know how much you haven't recovered from as a child? Have one.
Mm. Yeah.
So some of the things that I dealt with, I didn't realize. I thought that I had got enough healing, or I had talked to enough people. And then I had my first child and I realized all of it came snowballing back.
Yeah.
Because when when you go to parent your child, or when you go to think about the things in which your child could potentially come across, you know, my first child was my daughter. Right. So in my mind, you know, we're in a time where human trafficking and sex trafficking is very huge.
Yeah.
You know, people have the campaign Save the Children, you know, to whereby, you know, young children are being, you know, abused on such a magnanimous, on an international level,
yeah.
You know, to whereby these are things that, you know, kidnappings that I have to think about, you know, when my daughter's walking alone, teaching her self-defense, teaching her, you know, the universal, you know, weapon safety rules, teaching her how to, you know, properly handle a firearm, you know, when she becomes of age, all of those things that I start to think about. And then it triggers me to my own past of the things that I dealt with and what she could potentially deal with in her own future and how to better equip her. And then I had 2 sons.
Have you ever had this experience? Because I have a lot of nieces and nephews. I don't have any brothers and sisters, so my good friends give me their children as nieces and nephews. But
indeed.
Have you ever heard a family member's voice come out of your mouth? Example.
Yes.
For me, I remember one time one of my goddaughter was sapping. She was eating and going like this. And I said, and I turned around and I said, stop that. And I heard my auntie's voice coming out of my mouth when I was maybe 10 years old and I was eating, watching TV, and she yelled at me to stop that. And like, to this day, I'm trying to figure out how can I go back to my niece and apologize to her to fix that so that she doesn't do that to somebody else, because it's someone that does it to you and it hurts you, may not have physically hurt, but it hurt you, and then without even thinking, I transfer it on to someone else.
Yep.
So you've had that experience.
I think it kind of speaks to the notion that, and I'm not sure where I remember hearing this this quote from, if you never heal, you will end up bleeding on people that never cut you.
Right.
So in that regard, if you've never bandaged...
That's very intense.
Indeed. So in that regard, in terms of your life, if you've never healed from the things and the traumas in which you dealt with, then you will end up pushing those mindsets and those ideologies off on either your mentees, more specifically in my case, my children, so I confront those. One specific thing that I know for a fact that I confront is the idea between correction and abuse. You know, so my mother, and let me preface before saying this, we have a much better relationship now. I've fully forgiven her for the things in which she's put me and my brothers through, but she abused us as children. And she acknowledges that, and we've, you know, worked through that. But for me, I do not physically reprimand my children before talking to them. And that's something that I consciously do, because back then there was no talking. There was no walk over to the socket. This is a socket. You do not put a fork in the... No. There was no talking. There was a slapping on your hand, or you got hit with something. Yeah. And you just knew, you associated that area with pain.
Yeah.
So whereby to me, it's much more powerful to walk over and educate in that regard, to whereby now, if I'm going to hold you accountable, it's because I've taught you. I don't hold, and my wife and I, we're on the same page with that, to whereby if they're doing something that we have not said, hey, listen, that's, you know, we don't do that, you know? Now, the I call them the cliches or the euphemisms, if you will, mm-hmm. that my grandmother used to say, you know, growing up, like, for example, you know, my daughter fall out, you know, on the ground. Well, if you fall out, I'm going to fall out right on with you. You know, I'm going to get right on down there with you. You throw a temper tantrum, I'm going to get down there and throw a bigger temper tantrum.
Yeah.
You know, if you show out in public, I'm going to show out better than you. You know, those types of, you know, quirky little things that we say. But I had to realize, too, that those things can contribute to that emotional trauma. And I don't want to raise children, and this is a personal declaration that I have, I do not want to raise children that have to recover from, I don't want to raise adults that have to continually recover from their childhood.
Mm.
And I think utilizing that as a mindset moving forward, as well as those around me, you know, the men of all different walks of life that, you know, have children that, you know, attach themselves to me and we have conversation, I ask them, how often do you talk to your children? What do you mean? How often do you talk to them? Just general conversation. Me and my wife, we don't do the baby talk. You know, the goo-goo guy, we don't do that.
Yeah.
We talk to them as if they're young children. Yeah. You know, I'm speaking to you in complete sentences.
Yeah, they're
you
people.
Know?
And they understand right. when you speak to them like they're people.
Right. So in my, Renee, to go back to your question about my first poem, Black Girl Magic, in that I started off with, you know, to the guy in Walmart who called his daughter a B in front of me, the B word, those types of things, you know, guys who legitimately disrespect their children, more specifically their daughters, that they grow up with these mindsets that this is what love is. And I had to realize that my traumas were spilling over into, you know, my children, and not in the sense of abuse or anything like that. I would have to retreat to my own. My anxiety would like go through the roof.
Yeah.
Like, why am I feeling this? Why am I feeling this way? Because in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if I just whoop them, it'd be easier.
Yeah.
Whereby it's like, no, that's not the way. Talk to them first. To me, physical correction should be a last resort. And my wife and I are on the same page with that. Now, I'm a firm believer in whoopings. Let me say that. But there's a huge difference between whoopings
And abuse. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huge difference. I'm not doing no prolonged 20-minute whooping. To me, there's nothing corrective about that. You know what I mean? To me, that's abuse.
Yeah.
You know, I may give them, you know, two taps or three taps. That's it.
Yeah.
Meaningful. Rah-rah-rah. Rah-rah. That's it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you know, hey, listen, let's have that, you know, that conversation of this is why we don't do this. Or this is, and again, after a certain point, I truly do believe that you should not even have to resort to that anymore, because you should have set your expectations down so much. Again, big difference between correction and abuse, or
yeah.
whoopings and abuse.
Yeah.
You know, just a tap on the hand. No, we don't do that. I don't have to full off and whoop you because you flipped the bowl over on the table and your Cheerios fell on the floor. That's not cause for a full on, you know, whooping.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. We don't do this. Now you pick it up, because I'm not your maid. you're going to pick up every single kernel of Cheerio and you're going to put it back in this bowl, and then you're going to go dump it in the trash because you can't eat it no more.
Yeah.
And then you're not going to waste daddy's food that he worked so hard. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you teach that lesson in the process. And I think for me, being abused forced me to retreat to what I call this mental shell.
Mm-hmm.
To whereby I didn't want to have those uncomfortable conversations. I didn't want to confront those mindsets because it was easier for me to just say that, you know what? Well, if I just whoop my kids, they'll be all right. But then I had a child and realized, yeah, it's not as easy as you might think it is.
Yeah.
You know,
we all tend to have that, like, before we have kids or before we're even, like, interacting with a lot of children, we're like, yo, for sure, going to get that ass whooping if they get out of line. But then when you're around children and you realize that they're really, really, really smart, they pick up on everything, even as young as 1 and 2 years old, they pick up on everything that you do, you say, your emotional energy. And so it shifts the way that you want to orient yourself. And I'm often in groups where younger people are talking about having children, and they're like, yeah, I'm going to beat my kids. And I'm just like, well, do you know difference between discipline and abuse?
Right.
Do you understand?
And it's definitely not something that you need to be super excited about.
Yeah.
You know, in that regard, you know, I would often ask myself, you know, you hear as a child, oh, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. And there were plenty of times where I wanted to say, well, give me the belt. Let's test this theory out. give me the belt, you know. Let's go ahead and see if this is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt me. And, you know, again, you know, confront. Not only confronting that, I think what was even more powerful with those experiences is not just having children, but talking to other men that have been through it as well.
Yeah.
So where do you go from there? So you have a child and you realize that you have this trauma. What do you do to get over that and to encourage them to be better and to do better and to not repeat the past?
You talking about the parent or you yourself?
The parent or anybody out there who has any sort of experience of trauma. Uh-huh. You know, how did you manage to overcome, and what did you do? Like, was it therapy? Was it talking? What was it?
I think the first step is identification. Knowing is half the battle, and it's one of the most powerful self-reflections. I one of the